Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. This is the week of the Alaska Festival of Native Arts, and so we're going to talk about some Native concerns and issues, because I'm going to work on the premise that there are a number of people in our audience who are newcomers to this state, as I am. Well, I'm not total newcomer. I've been here for a little over 5 years, but certainly I was not here at the time of the D2 Native Claim Settlement Act. I was not here in the 50s and 60s, and there are many issues and concerns which are garnering a lot of press attention now, whose origins I was not aware of. I was not here at the time that these issues were being decided. With me in the studio is Drina McIntyre, an Alaskan native, Alaskan-born person, very activist individual. I've had pleasure of serving with her on a board, and more recently she has been the coordinator for the World Eskimo Indian Olympics for the last 2 years. Welcome, Drina.
Hi.
And Jane Envick. Jane has recently served for 8 years?
6 years.
6 years on the Anchorage Municipal
Assembly.
And has also had as a very special interest, since she has been in this state, Native issues and Native concerns, and is presently serving as the president of the Alaska Native Foundation.
That's correct.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about what the foundation does and what its purpose is, to just begin?
The Alaska Native Foundation is a nonprofit association that was established back in 1968, and its principal goals are to serve as an advocate on behalf of Alaska Native people, particularly in the areas of education, research, leadership promotion, and cultural promotion. The Native Foundation should not be confused with the Alaska Federation of Natives, and the biggest difference is that AFN is the political spokesperson for Native concerns. The Native Foundation is not a political organization. We are much more a service organization who provides programs like the Alaska Native Leadership Program, or we provide technical assistance to village corporations in land planning. Additionally, we're currently in the process of producing a series of 6 television shows for high school level students on the subject of what is the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, where did it come from, who did it affect, and what's going to happen in the future. So the Native Foundation seeks funds from private foundations, from donations, also receives some money from the state of Alaska and the federal government to provide services to Native people across the state.
How long has it been in existence?
Since 1968.
That's not a recent organization. It has a long history.
It was actually established at land claims, the effort for Native people to be able to secure title to the lands that their families had lived on for generations, I could give you a long story. I'd say that it really started culminating probably in about 1966. And the foundation was established in 68 to help Native people with that effort in trying to secure a settlement to the claims that they had for the lands in Alaska with Congress. And at that time, it was the Ford Foundation that had provided significant financial support for Native people to be able to pursue that through the vehicle of the foundation.
Let's do the long version, because one of the privileges of this show is that it is an hour long, and we don't have commercials, and we in fact have time to explore some issues in some depth. There wasn't the concept, let me ask this as a real question. Was there the concept of land ownership for the Alaska Native peoples historically? I mean, prehistorically, did people own land?
Basically, the answer is no, but then there's going to be exceptions as soon as I say that. There are many different cultures among Alaska Native people, and it was, in fact, the land claims movement where the word Native ever even came into existence, because prior to that time, people were either Tlingits or Aleuts or Athabascans or Yupiks or Inupiata or Tsimshian, and that notion that I was a Native is something that was created for the purposes of talking about all these people in one word.
In a lump, which...
and there are different cultural experiences within each of those groups. And I suspect that in the Southeast there was more settled communities where people actually had more ownership-looking things going on than in some of the more nomadic groups. But the notion that somebody had a deed and said, this piece of ground belongs to me, is totally foreign to that community. Okay. I'll just talk for a second and then you can interrupt me. Once upon a time... The Native people lived here largely undisturbed in what their activities were, and then along came some Russians who decided that they would like to start some trade and commerce activities, and as a result they had a toehold in Kodiak and Sitka and a couple other locations on the southeast coast, and having had that presence for about 100 years, they then the Tsar was having trouble back home back in about 1867, and he had a financial drain not dissimilar from some things that this country might be experiencing today, and he was fighting a war at home. So he needed some cash, and he agreed to sell the Russian interest in Alaska to the United States government, and they did so for $7 million in 1867. The only thing that's important about that is that right in the Bill of Sale, which is called the Article of Secession, it says the people who live in Alaska will not be disturbed in their continued occupation and use of the territory, and the United States government has the obligation to deal with their claims in the future for the lands that they occupy. So that's where we start with this issue of Alaska Native claims. Then several things happened over the course of years, and there was more federal laws like the Organic Act, and I'm trying to remember, but I think that was about 1920-something, maybe.
Drina's nodding yes.
Back there someplace.
Anyway, the Organic Act was, no, it wasn't the 1920s, it was the late 1800s, turn of the century. Basically, people were... coming to Alaska to look for minerals, and the federal government passed a law that said the Native people of Alaska would not be disturbed in their use and occupancy of their land when the federal government provided access to people to be able to look for gold. And this was all mostly going on in the Southeast, although by the turn of the century we were in Nome and the Klondike and all of the rest of that. But the federal policy was that Native people would not be disturbed in their use and occupancy of the land, in spite of the fact that the federal government was making efforts to try and open up the territory of Alaska for more people to come and explore for resources. And that's another sort of important law that affects and sets in motion the kinds of legal history that preceded the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The next probably big thing that happened was statehood in 1959. Now, we obviously jumped a whole bunch of years and there were other laws that were passed, but critical is that when the people of Alaska tried to pursue statehood, the Constitutional Convention, which met right here in this city in 1956 for a year, looked at the issue of whether or not they would deal with Alaska Native claims in their effort to achieve statehood. And once again, as in other laws that had been written, they took one giant step sideways and said, that is to be dealt with in the future. One of the things that did happen, however, with statehood is that nobody believed that Seward's Folly, that frozen place up there, could actually survive as an economic entity. So the federal government made a terrific deal with Alaska in the Statehood Act, which said, you know, Alaska, you're probably so poor that you're going to be a millstone around our neck for a long time unless you've got some money of your own. So we, the federal government, own Alaska. And we, the federal government, hereby give Alaska, the new state of Alaska, the right to select 104 million acres of land, which represents about 25% of Alaska. And with that land, you can then make some money. And that's how you can make your government work, because you guys don't have an economy other than a few fish and a few trees.
And our military, and our federal military presence.
Oh, absolutely.
Which was significant at that time.
And in fact, still is very significant to the economy of the state of Alaska. So the state had the right to select 104 million acres of land, and after its creation, proceeded in the early 60s with that activity. And that is the first time when there started to be some significant conflicts between people who lived in rural areas and villages and interests that of the state in selecting lands. And one, of course, is pretty close to Fairbanks, which was Minto Flats. It was proposed that there be a road that be built to Minto. And then people from Fairbanks could come up and go duck hunting on the flats. And people who lived in Minto didn't think that was a very good idea. And there was going to be a selection right around Minto to make it like a park, I think. And the guys in Minto didn't think that was a very good idea, because that was lands that they had been using for hunting and fishing forever. And all of a sudden the state was going to carve out a little piece and say, this is public lands, and therefore, and then we'll have the road, and then we'll drive everybody from Fairbanks to come up and visit. And the guys in Minto didn't think that was a very good idea. Similarly, there were other kinds of efforts that were going on. In Rampart, the federal government was interested in building a dam that would flood out four villages, and that was for some source of energy for the interior. On the far west coast by Point Hope, and the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission was interested in doing atomic testing for weapons, and thought that the rationale was that they could blast a harbor for the people there, for trade and commerce. Although the people up there, this was actually the beginning of the Tundra Times, and Howard Rock, who lived in Point Hope, thought that was a pretty lousy idea, and started a newspaper to say, whoa, wait a minute, what we know about all of this is that the potential for radioactive fallout to go through our ecosystem in a snap is very great, and we don't think that's a very good idea. And actually, those devices were actually ready to come. They were put on railroad cars out of someplace in New Mexico and were on their way up here before that was successfully halted. But all of that goes to say that there was sort of a growing problem that Native people started to experience about different kinds of interests who wanted to use and occupy the lands that they were using and occupying for different purposes. In 1966 was the first time when Native people came together at a meeting in Anchorage. And with the exception probably of the people who had gone to school at Mount Edgecombe, and therefore Eskimo and Indian and Aleut people had mixed previously in high school at Mount Edgecombe and Sitka, this meeting in 1966 was probably the first time when people from very distinct and different and previously in the past often warring groups of people came together to try to look at a problem that was common to all of them. And they did. And the leaders among the people at that time were Willie Hensley and Emil Noddy, and from this region, Don Wright, and now I'm going to probably get in a lot of trouble for missing important names, but suffice to say that in 1966 people got together and said, the real problem we have is land, and we will lose everything that we've ever done in terms of how we use this place, even though nobody had a piece of paper that said, this is my piece of ground and this is my house and the rest of you people go away. The traditions and the patterns of use and occupancy go on from time immemorial. So at that time they started the effort for Alaska Native claims. At one point in time, there were many details that go on from here, but importantly are a couple. One is that both the federal government and the state government had an interest in what was happening here. And at that time, Wally Hickel was the governor, and he set up a task force for the purposes of taking a look at the issue. And I think that I am told at any rate that the real structure of what the settlement might look like was largely pounded out in that task force at that time. Additionally, there were fundamental decisions made along the way. Number one is that the fight was between the United States government and Alaska Native people. The state was just over here, but they were not the owners of the property. The federal government was. The second choice was that we would go for a congressional settlement to the claims rather than going through the courts. And the reason for that is that in Southeast Alaska, well, the principal reason is the courts can give money, but the courts do not have the authority to convey land. And only the federal government, through Congress, had the capacity to be able to say, this is a resource that's owned by the United States government, and we hereby provide it for you in relation to your claims. But additionally, in Southeast Alaska, the experience with the U.S. Court of Claims was, I think, that the Tlingit and Haida people went to court over lands that were lost in 1920, and by 19, it was 25 years before the Court of Claims provided a financial settlement to the claims of the Tlingit and Haida people in Southeast. And even then, the only provision is that the courts can award damages for lands that were lost or illegally taken, but they can't provide the restoration of the lands. So,
just let me interrupt here to say that in celebration of the Festival of Native Arts, we are discussing some of the background of the Native Claims Settlement Act, and I am speaking with Jane Anvik, who is president of the Alaska Native Foundation, and Drina McIntyre.
Okay. So, people got together and they decided they were going to go to the United States Congress and they were going to claim the lands that had been occupied and used by Native people. At different times in that process, now it's 66, 67, 68, there were different groups of people and different groups of Native people actually filed claims against the United States Department of Interior, saying these lands are ours, and at one point in time, every inch of the state of Alaska had been claimed by Alaska Native people as having been occupied or traditionally used in some form or manner in the past. And based on the Treaty of Cession, it says you guys have to deal with these people at some time in the future and their right to the land. Based on the Organic Act, we're not going to disturb people in their right and occupancy of the land. There was a legal history in the United States that provided for what is called legally a legitimate claim against the United States government. So when it came to saying how do we resolve the claim, we have basically two sides in a trade. I say that I have this because we have always used it, and you are the federal government, and you say, well, now we got to be reasonable here because, we got cities, we got people, we got farms, we got a lot of people out there, we got national parks, you got to be, you know, rational and reasonable in what you want. So we have a bargaining situation. This is a negotiation between people who have a legitimate claim to land and people who have the capacity to determine how much land they're going to get and what they would get for lands that they, in fact, are a legitimate claim for, but which the government simply says, we can't give that to you because Fairbanks is sitting there, or because Mount McKinley or Denali National Park has already been established and we've already created other uses for those lands that you claim. And in that case, what do we compensate you for the loss of that legitimate claim? Well, for years, it went back and forth and back and forth, and many things happened, and one great fun event was that Wally Hickel was the governor of the state of Alaska, and then when Richard Nixon was elected president of the United States, Richard Nixon asked Wally Hickel to serve as his Secretary of the Interior, and I believe that was in 1968, right? So in 69, the governor chose to become the Secretary of Interior, but in order to become that position, he had to go through confirmation hearings in the United States Senate. And prior to this time, the governor was very reticent about land claims. And the reason he was reticent about land claims is his successor, who was Interior Secretary, right, I'll think of it in a second, Stuart Udall, had completely changed the situation. As sort of the last act of that administration, Alaska Native people had appealed to the Secretary of Interior and saying, we need the land, but we're never going to get it unless you intercede and you have the authority to be able to freeze all transactions about the movement of lands in Alaska until this issue is settled. And the only reason that's important is because in 1969, oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay, and they wanted to build the pipeline. And in order to build the pipeline, the people who wanted to build the pipeline needed to have a permit from the United States Department of Interior across federal lands for the corridor of the pipeline. So the Secretary of Interior said, nobody gets to move. State of Alaska, you don't get to select your lands. People who want to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, you don't get your permit. Nobody gets to do anything until the issue of Alaska Native claims is settled. And he did that with the power of the Secretary of Interior. Well, at that time, Wally Hickel was the governor, and he was mad, as were many, many people in Alaska. They were going to stop the pipeline, they were going to stop the continuation of state selections and the ability of the state to earn money off of those lands. And they tried unsuccessfully to get it reversed. So now we have Wally Hickel becoming the Secretary of Interior. And the question becomes, where are you on the Alaskan land freeze? And Mr. Hickel really didn't want to continue the Alaskan land freeze, but was persuaded by members of the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, because they said, you don't get confirmed unless you agree to maintain this land freeze. So the
difficult position to be in.
Yeah.
So he continued the land freeze, and what you had then was a situation where you had the state of Alaska, the international oil companies, Alaska Natives, all on the same side for a while there, you know, trying to pursue a settlement for Alaska Native people. And there are those today who, in retrospect, would say that if it hadn't been particularly for the pipeline, land claims never would have been adopted at all. Anyway, so by 1971, there was progress being made in Congress, and there were as many different versions of the bill as there probably were congressmen and senators in terms of what was fair and what was equitable, and much negotiation back and forth. And the House had one version, the Senate had another version, and the administration, the Nixon administration, had yet another version. So things are typical of what happens to legislative bodies. But the net result was that there were several compromises and an agreement was reached on what would be a reasonable bill. And the bill was passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by Richard Nixon on December 18th, 1971. And the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act provided for the return of 44 million acres of land to Alaska Native people. That represents about 11% of Alaska. And it provided for the lands that they had legitimately claimed. Remember, there's like 330 million acres here. For the lands that they couldn't have because we had cities on them or whatever reason, there would be a cash payment of almost $1 billion. It's $997.5 million. Half of that money would come from the federal treasury, and half of the money would basically come from the state of Alaska from its royalties on the pipeline. Now, it's a little complicated to say how all this works out, but here are the key points. No Alaska Native person received title to 1 square inch of ground. The holders of the land and the holders of the money are corporations. Individual Alaska Native people are shareholders in the corporation. An individual Native person owns a share of stock, in fact, owns 100 shares of stock in their corporation. the owners of the land and the owners of the money are the corporations, and the individual has the ability to participate, to vote in annual meetings, to express their point of view about how the corporations manage the assets of the land and the money. In Alaska, there are 12 regional corporations, and then there is a 13th corporation, which is located outside in Seattle for Alaska Native people who are not living in Alaska. In addition to those regional corporations, there are over 200 village corporations. And an individual Native person could opt to enroll to a village corporation and a regional corporation, or if the person was not living in a village and wasn't connected to a village, they could opt to not enroll to a village corporation and just enroll to the regional corporation, and then their share of benefits increased for not being part of a village corporation. Anyway, so it keep in mind that in Alaska, we started off with diverse people, different cultures. Now we have 12 regional corporations, the 13th outside. The 13th corporation, by the way, has no land. They just have money. 200 village corporations. And all of a sudden, we've created businesses. And the reason that the corporate structure was selected, in my conversations with many of the people who participated in that decision, is that if they looked at the models that were available, what was out there was reservations is one tool that was being used in the lower 48. And after cruising through a few reservations, people decided they didn't think that was a very good idea. And if, in fact, we were going to move into the 21st and the 22nd century here, then let's use a tool that would provide us with some ability to be able to provide two things. One is both access to some economic activity for the future, as well as a vehicle that is understood and recognized by the larger non-Native society as something of value. So the corporate decision was made, and was made very early on, that they would go for a corporation as opposed to a reservation.
And this was a Native decision?
Yes. There were many, many, many attorneys involved in the crafting of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. There are some heroes, in fact, that should probably be sung. And one is the village of Tyonek, on the west side of Cook Inlet. Tyonek had successfully secured some money from an offshore oil and gas lease sale right off the shore of the village. And Tyonek bankrolled this operation from 1966 probably right through to 1971. And they often get lost in the history books as a group of people who really deserve a lot of thanks. Most of the attorneys, and there are many of them right here in Fairbanks who worked on land claims, worked for years without any compensation. They were compensated when the act was passed, and a portion of money was set aside to pay for lawyers' times. But I don't think they got paid really all the time and money that they were devoted. And there were lots of other. There were clearly, probably a handful of 40 or 50 Native people who never saw their families for 5-6 years while they were pursuing dealing with Congress and dealing with people who wore coats and ties every day, all day. So there were a lot of people who really worked hard to achieve the law that was finally adopted. But the key elements are a corporate structure was established. The 44 million acres of land and the $1 billion were going to go to the corporations. The corporations then had the obligation to be basically the steward of those resources. The Claims Act was established in such a way that for the first 5 years, from 1971 to 1976, the money would be distributed in a formula basis such that there would actually be some direct cash payment to individuals. However, when it in the money didn't come all at one time. The money was spread out over an 11-year period of time. And during the time between 1971 and 1982, the United States experienced its highest degree of inflation, probably since the Civil War. The result was that the purchasing power of what sounded like an enormous settlement in 1971 was substantially undermined by 20% inflation that occurred in a time when the money had still not arrived in Alaska. The average payment to an individual Alaska Native person, cash, is $303 from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Now, what that means is that there was money that came directly from, there's like 70,000 Native people, but there was a portion of the money that had to go directly to the individuals. That's that, and that was just for the first couple of years. Then after that, any money that was going to come to an individual shareholder comes in the form of a dividend, just as if you own stock in IBM or anything else. If they make money, then you make money. If they don't make money, you don't get a dividend. And there are some corporations that have been very successful and have paid dividends, and there are other corporations that have not been successful and have not paid dividends. So I guess one thing I really want to stress is that Alaska Native people individually did not get rich as a result of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
I'm speaking with Jane Anvik. She is the president of the Alaska Native Foundation, which is an educational group that encourages leadership and information about Alaska Natives and Native concerns. Before we go on with that, Drina, you were born in
Ketchikan.
Ketchikan. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your parents.
Okay, my dad is full-blooded Tsimshian Indian from Metlakatla, which is, by the way, one of the few reservations in the state of Alaska. And my mother is half Aleut, and the other half is Russian and Norwegian. And she was born on Unga Island out in the Shumagins in the Aleutian chain. And they met each other in Mount Edgecombe in the early 50s. They were both going to school. I think at that time they had vocational courses there, and so it was like after graduation from high school, and my mom went into nursing, and my dad just went into working with tools and woodworking and stuff like that. And they both still live in Ketchikan.
Yeah. That was that time that they were going to Mount Edgecombe. Many of future Native leaders who were involved in the decisions that Jane was just discussing were going to school there at that time. Do they talk about their time at Edgecombe as a real peak experience?
Well, the one thing that my mom speaks of fondly is just all the friends she made from all over the state, Eskimos, Athabascans, people that she never had a chance to meet with before. And as a matter of fact, her best friend in nursing school is now, is the mother of my best friend here in Fairbanks, an Athabascan woman from Rampart. So
That's an interesting idea about Edgecombe, and you alluded to that, Jane, that going to school there sometimes was the first exposure that really very diverse people with very diverse cultures had of coming in contact with each other. And for them, for someone growing up in the Shumagins, to meet an Athabascan from interior Alaska is
pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing. Great cultural divergence. And I think that we as non-Natives really need to appreciate how much divergence and diversity there is, and distinct languages. There isn't a common language, and we need to not lose sight of that. Were the corporations divided in terms of Native, previous Native groupings?
The boundaries were drawn along cultural lines as much as possible, and there are a lot of flukes associated with that whenever you start drawing lines on maps that try and reflect things, you know, like particularly I'd say between the boundary line between Athabascan and Eskimo gets real blurry down by Anvik and places in the western part of the state, so that the line perhaps between Doyon and Calista is not as precise as it might otherwise be, similarly between Doyon and Bering Straits. But in general, the effort was to identify the cultural group and people who had common experiences in hunting and fishing activities, so that you have Eskimo, Inupiaq Eskimo people with Inupiaq Eskimo people, and Athabascan people with Athabascan people, and like uh-huh. that. And so, broadly speaking. Broadly.
And then appreciating, of course, that there were many people like Drina's parents who, in fact, were from two very different cultural backgrounds, who then met at Edgecombe, married, and settled in sure. Ketchikan, which was your father's
yeah.
home,
mm-hmm.
but certainly mm-hmm. not your mother's, so that nothing is static. There's great mixing. You were growing up at that time. Do you remember conversations in your home about the decisions that were being made? What was your impression in schools?
The first exposure I had to the land claims was finding out that I was getting a large sum of money putting into my bank account for college, and I was fairly young. I was 14, and that was the first time I'd even heard about it. I wasn't reading newspapers a lot or anything back then, but so I wasn't in the thick of things at all. I was too young. But my parents didn't really talk about it that much either. They were interested in what was going on, but I guess I was too young to grasp the meaning and the importance of what was happening.
That underlines the fact that there's a lot of education going on of young Native students who were, in fact, very young at the time these decisions were being made, and who are going to be the leaders soon, and that really need to appreciate the background. The idea that getting ready for 1991, and I want to get to that, that they need some background, some understanding of the great complexity that went into making the decisions in 71.
Right. Well, there are many issues associated with what happens to the young people who will become the leaders of tomorrow, and sort of the most critical one for a very young person is that the only people who can be shareholders in Alaska Native corporations are people who were alive as of December 18th, 1971. There's a cutoff date such that people who were born after that date, and we've got lots of them by now, are not shareholders. And that when the corporate structure was decided to be the vehicle, in order for a corporation to function like a corporation, it has to be a finite creature that has, some kind of boundary around it, so that you know that if you're trying to create value, what your value is created relative to how many people you've got. And one of the issues that has come up since 1971 and will be addressed, hopefully, with the 1991, I can explain that 1991 thing real quickly. Let me do that. You hear lots about 1991, like the boogeyman is out there. And perhaps to just explain a little bit, one of the things that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which people call ANCSA, did was protect these new foundling corporations for a 20-year period of time. And it said that these are closed creatures and that Native people can be shareholders, but they cannot sell their stock to anyone for a 20-year period of time, the intention being that within that time frame, people would learn how to run businesses and learn how to be able to create an economically viable operation. And that after that 20-year period of time, that protection can be lifted such that corporate stock could be sold to anyone for whatever the price would be. So when people talk about 1991, what they are really focusing on, although there are many issues, is that protection for the sale of the stock is removed. And what will happen is, the way the law is written right now, everyone's 100 shares of stock will be called back to the corporation, and on January 1st, 1992, they will have new stock that will be issued, which is quite available to be sold to anyone for whatever price. And as people started looking at that, there was growing concern that it's possible, for any number of reasons, that the corporations would fall out of the control of Native people and could essentially be taken over by other interests. And depending on your point of view, whether people would try to take over wildly successful corporations or people would try to take over marginal corporations in an effort to be able to have access to the land is sort of the who knows what would happen. And people go, well, hell's bells. If people want to sell the stock, that's their business. Why is anybody worried about this? And what Native people are trying to do is create a package of amendments for consideration by the United States Congress that would amend a couple of provisions of the law to provide one more step in that process. And the step is in relation to the selling the stock would be that everybody who's a shareholder would have to decide by majority vote if anybody would be able to sell their stock. And what that does is provide one more set of choices for Native people as a group, as opposed to individual choices about what individual people can do. And there may still be plenty of corporations who by majority vote say, yes, we want to be able to sell our stock, and so be it. But what Native people are really going to be doing is asking Congress for one more choice before that becomes a reality. And in any corporation in the business world, if you are a privately held corporation, of which probably the vast majority of corporations are, the decision to become a public corporation is one that is in fact made by the group. It is not simply imposed upon you by some arbitrary time frame of the law. And that's the choice that the Native people will be pursuing in the 1991 amendments. But that's critical mass. That's number one and probably the most important. Paralleling that, right next to it, is a provision that says that dissenters, I didn't like the decision of the group. Let's say that the group decides that they don't want to sell stock, and I decide I do want to sell stock because my situation is peculiar to me. I've got sick kids, or I've got three kids in college, or I've got to make some choices that I need to money for. And that there would be another amendment that would say that should the dissenter try and bring suit against the organization because their right, their property right was reduced, that the corporation has a responsibility for basically buying out that person. That the United States Congress or the United States government will not be held liable for suits that would be brought by dissenters. That the corporation holds a responsibility for settling with somebody who doesn't like the decision of the majority. That was a two-day discussion at the last AFN meeting about which kind of amendments we're going to do. A couple other amendments would be to try and deal with the issue of the kids. Does the corporation have the right to be able to include other people than those who were members as of December 1971?
I have a question. What was the reason that they decided that anyone born after that date would not be a member of the corporation?
A corporation is a closed vehicle. In order for, by its very nature, you enclose it and say these are the assets of this creature and these are the members of this creature. unlike a reservation, unlike a tribal government, it is not open for all time to members of this community, because the value of whatever your stuff is divided by the number of people who own shares. And it's if you compare it to, let's say, you own IBM stock. You are a shareholder of IBM because you put up your money. Anybody who didn't put up their money can't be a member of that. In the same way, people who are members of Native corporations are members of Native corporations by virtue of their nativeness as of a certain point in time. So one of the amendments would say, could the corporation basically provide a different kind of stock to the children who were born after? The intention was that all the young people would inherit stock from people who died, and that's the way it would be continued. But we have more kids than we have people dying, and the delusion effect of one person with 12 grandchildren is pretty significant. So the notion is, could Native corporations provide a second kind of stock that would be issued for what they call new natives or afterborn? But see, this is a problem. In some families, you've got kids who are shareholders and kids who aren't.
Right.
You, mm-hmm. I mean, we've really created a real crazy situation.
Of course, that's always been a problem of inheritance. In Europe, the whole issue of primogeniture, the firstborn getting the land and the rest having to go into the church or
right.
whatever.
Birth
order
is always
always difficult.
Anyway, but in order for a separate kind of stock to be issued for young people or the new people that are coming, then the group as a whole, all shareholders, have to vote to say, yes, we want to give that kind of a special asset to our children. And in order to do so, we are willing to reduce the value of the corporation's assets by whatever increment that would occur. And the same is true for trying to provide benefits to elders. We've got the young and the old. There are many corporations who are taking a look at the elder people in their corporation who are still very often in poverty situations, and they would like to provide special benefits to their elders, maybe additional cash benefits. But in order to do that, they need the group as a whole, as the corporation, to vote to provide those benefits to those people today, now while they're alive, thus reducing the value of the whole corporation's assets. And you know, in American business, the theory is that you, over time, you get progressively more profitable, and over time you will be able to provide those kinds of benefits to everyone. Well, if you wait for that to happen, in some cases, all those elders are going to have long since passed away. So if another kind of amendment is, can we, by majority vote, reduce the value of our assets by providing special benefits to our elders or special benefits to our children? Similarly, there's a couple other ones like taxation. And basically what that says is that another 20-year protection of ANCSA was that there could be no property taxes assessed against corporate holdings for a 20-year period of time. And people are concerned that, particularly as the state of Alaska declines in its revenues, people are going to start looking around trying to figure out a new source of income. And if you could put a property tax on 40 million acres of land, that'd be probably a pretty good source of income. Or in the case of places where we do have organized boroughs, I know in Anchorage, if we had the ability to tax Aklutna lands — Aklutna is the village corporation that is near Anchorage, I mean in the boundaries of the municipality — Aklutna is the single largest landowner in Anchorage. If we had the ability to levy property taxes on their hundreds of acres of undeveloped lands, hey, that'd be good tax revenues for Anchorage. But it would completely bust Aklutna. their ability to be able to pay the taxes is, I mean, that land is undeveloped. We can't tax undeveloped lands. Corporations pay profit taxes just like any other corporation. Corporations pay taxes on businesses that and lands that are viable ventures that are making money. They just don't pay taxes on undeveloped lands at this time. So one of the proposed amendments is to have a continued protection from the taxation of undeveloped lands. In the case of particularly village corporations, that's very critical because village corporations are largely undercapitalized. They probably had $50,000 to start a business, and if they had to turn around and start paying property taxes on, you know, maybe they've got a average village probably has maybe 7,000 acres, something like that. Well, man, it's over. The ball game is over. They'd have to sell the land to be able to pay the taxes. And so there is an effort to try to continue the prohibition against taxation on undeveloped lands into the future. Then finally, there's an effort to try to say, if the land, the way the corporation was set up, the land and the money all became the in one place. And when the business of the corporation, whether it's a regional corporation or a village corporation, has problems, there's potential that we could lose the land. And in at least one case, in the village of Heidelberg, that, in fact, is exactly the case that people find themselves in, where the land was put up as collateral for a loan out of a Seattle bank, and then there was a business difficulty which resulted in the loan not being repaid, and the question now becomes, does the bank in Seattle own Heidelberg? If the point of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was to provide and return the lands to Native people, the notion that within 20 years we've lost it, it somehow seems a little incongruous. So the other amendment is, could lands, assets of the corporation, be taken out of the larder of the corporation and put in a safe place, such as a land bank or some other entity, where they are no longer subject to the flukes of business? And that's another kind of amendment that people are pursuing in relation to Congress. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, what 1991 is all about. But in order to amend the Claims Act before 1991, there's going to be a lot of activity in 1986 to try to pursue that.
Just briefly, could you give a little information to our audience on the sovereignty issue? I think it's something that's...
Oh, sovereignty, that great red flag of...
it's such a powerful word. I mean, it seems like such a...
There, over time, I'd say that it's not... It could have been expected that people are wondering... The Native community is probably somewhat divided at this point on this issue. And what I can say about sovereignty is that there are people who, particularly as a result of the potential of Alaska Native people losing their land under the corporate structure, have come to believe that the corporate structure that was created by ANCSA is so fundamentally flawed that they need another kind of system to be able to protect their land. Never be confused. Land is the base of what is being discussed here. Land and the ability to have some control over your own life. The people who are advocates of sovereignty, to one degree or another, are attempting to say the system that was created was not of our making, and somehow we have the potential of losing everything by a system that doesn't seem to recognize that there were other laws that were in place as well, stemming right from the United States Constitution, that recognized that the Alaska Native people and the United States government have a special relationship, which is comparable to the special relationship that American Indians have experienced in the lower 48, which legally says we are in a relationship not dissimilar from nation-to-nation relationship, because you guys were here first and we came second. And that's the kind of relationship that, by law, we have agreed to over time. If you say sovereignty, some people go crazy and they go, oh, I don't know what they want. If you say self-determination, self-government, people are a little less crazy on the subject. And I think what you'll see in the coming months is efforts of Native people to be able to have greater control over their lives. And number one is greater control over the land. If the land is lost, the ball game is over for rural Alaska. And by that I mean people in rural Alaska, which is where the subsistence issue comes in, depend on the access to those resources for their survival. This is not a cultural issue. This is not a racial issue. This is an economic issue. If access to those lands and those resources is diminished or taken away, the potential for extreme economic failure in rural Alaska, if people can't hunt and fish, they can't be there anymore. And that's, I think, the core of what sovereignty is all about. There is definitely a strong and different point of view about how to achieve self-determination. The Alaska Federation of Natives, on behalf of the corporations, in large measure have said, we need to pursue the amendments that I've just outlined in a unified way, and we cannot risk bringing up the issue of tribal sovereignty in the same breath that we talk about amending the Yangtze corporations. So AFN has said, and Senator Ted Stevens has enforced, that the issue of tribal sovereignty should not be put on the table at the same time as the Yangtze amendments. The advocates of tribal sovereignty say that that's nonsense and that we'll fight to the death to be able to provide both issues at the same time.
Tune in continuously for more information on this. It's a fascinating area, how you combine traditional needs and cultures with modern corporations and modern business in an ever-changing society. And we're all part of this, as Alaskan citizens, part of this decision-making process. And it's very helpful to have some background information.
Let me stress, all Alaskans have a stake in this. Private ownership of 11% of the state of Alaska is up for grabs. If those lands are owned by somebody else, even non-Native people are going to be affected by those decisions. So it's not as if this is strictly a Native thing that those people are doing over there. We are all involved in this.
And I hope that you have all been involved with the Festival of Native Arts, which is going on this afternoon. There will be dancing and a potlatch at West Valley High from 6:30 to 8 and dancing till midnight. And I hope you have taken advantage of some of the wonderful events that have been going on this week and are continuing today. I thank you very much for helping us with some of this background. Jane Anvik, who's president of the Alaska Native Foundation, and Drina McIntyre, who is a member of our community and very active in a number of ways. Thank you very much for both being with me. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer has been Carla Tanella. I hope you have a very good weekend. Go out and do some dancing.